We arrive at chapters 11 and 12 of the book of Exodus. The focus here is on the last plague and the institution of Passover. And maybe one of the leading questions here would be, how does the Passover ritual help shape a collective identity for the Israelites who are starting to be a people? Welcome to The Good Word. We continue our series on the book of Exodus. I am your host, Chiagua Heiss. I'm joined by my conversation partners, Dr. Matilda Fry and Dr. Jody Washburn. Friends, final plague and Passover. How do we make sense of these things? My mind, I'm not going to lie, I'm just going to go straight into what I love about this, is all the symbolism here, the symbolic actions. I know I asked a second ago, how does ritual or the Passover itself shape a collective identity for the Israelites? Symbolism is very significant here. I know as Christians, we turn to the bread and the wine to celebrate these things to this day. We don't do the blood on the doorposts, or I hope we don't, you know, that's then. But what's the role of all of these symbolic actions and their representativeness in how we think of ourselves as people of faith, as Israel, or so I don't know. These are just the thoughts I have. Tell me what's on your beautiful minds, my friends.
The firstborn who dies, of firstborn of everybody and everything, animals and humans.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing to grasp, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a segue from our previous lesson, right? About the undoing of the created order, where nature suffers with actions.
And then, so again, God is the actor. God is the one who brings this about.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the blood is the symbol for the protection.
Mm-hmm.
So God is the one who brings the death of the firstborn and also the protection of the people inside in the house. That is a lot to put together into one. One way of thinking about God.
Have you, Jody or Matilda, experienced a moment in class teaching where these questions have come up from students saying, okay, is this the God we worship? I mean, how do we...
It is hard to imagine these two contrasting ways of thinking and with the activities that come through that and put them together into one way of thinking of God, the conception of God, like being the God of grace, of love, and so on. We want to stay with that.
Yeah.
And we cannot even imagine the opposite to it.
Yeah.
And yet there it is in several parts in the biblical text, and here is one of those.
Yeah. I'm back to thinking, Matilda, of the question of the freedom of God. I think, Jody, you brought it up when we were talking about Brueggemann in previous episodes, you know, that the freedom of God is a problem to Pharaoh, who has this structure of empire in place. But what we're going to see throughout Exodus and Hebrew prophets onward in the Hebrew Bible is that the freedom of God is very problematic to the people too.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, not as an answer here to the tension you're bringing to the beginning of the episode here, Matilda, with the question of who is this God, right, who protects and takes life? But I wonder if we can just place that tension within this space of how free is God in our religion? Or does he just do according to what we expect him to do, regardless of the impulses of what that looks like are? So meaning if I'm a very conservative person, oh, God only behaves in this specific way, very little room for freedom. Or if I'm progressive or some people like the liberal, you know, I know who God is and he acts. And I wonder how both groups leave how much room for freedom, for God to do and move in ways that go beyond our comfort. And I wonder if there's something meaningful there in regards to how that can be a space where we can all sort of come together. We already know our differences or how people sort of choose sides on things, but I wonder if the freedom of God can continue to become such a problem that it brings us together. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but I wonder. How much freedom do we leave for God in our understanding of who he is and in how we exercise our faith and our trust in him? Questions I have. So this was therapy time at The Good Word, everybody. I love the idea of symbolism in this text. From the simple symbols, I think I have a quote here from, I don't think it's on this one, I think it's in the next lesson, from Eugene Peterson, of just simple meals before you leave and how these things are meaningful for how we move forward in life, the rituals, the symbolisms that we carry with us and that forge us in this realm of memory and hope. So I wonder, does symbolism have any part, does ritual have any part, any meaningful part in our life today as Christians, in your personal lives? Do you have any rituals that give sense to how you live? And how can we relate that to the things happening at the Passover, what God establishes there for the people?
Meaningful life of faith needs ritual, I think.
Yeah.
Ritual is what sustains that kind of life of relationality with God and with each other. Convey the way we feel and think through the exercise of rituals. And I think that is a major element in the biblical, in the Torah here, and will become, especially in the book of Leviticus, the element that is like takes us through the entire system of ritual of the tabernacle later on, in that sense,
Well, within Exodus, for sure, there's a reason why there's so much time given to the description of the sanctuary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a big difference between the prophetic way of living, which is spontaneous. Prayers happen in response to history in the moment, and the priestly way of living, which is ritual, which is organized. It's that which guarantees the relation between God and his people, regardless of the vicissitudes of time and the prophetic responses. So there's something to be said about the importance of sanctuary in Exodus, how that leads into Leviticus, and how meaningful that will be for the people onward. And it's interesting that while Moses has said, oh, I wish everybody was a prophet, you know, in that one episode with Joshua, the true intention of Moses was, you will be a kingdom of priests. And I wonder if when we get to that section, there's something to be said about ritual, about the ordering of life in such a way that gives heed to God. What I think it's super cool about, at least our text here, is the unleavened bread. I love that image. And how that represents just, and obviously coming from South America, I remember being a student there of theology, and my parents were pastors too, both my mom and my dad. I remember my mom going as a teacher into the slums of São Paulo to give classes or lectures after the class was over to help out students that were in need. And I used to go with her and my dad into these different spaces that were very different for people who lived in a different particular way. And to see how people ate and how they celebrated life, how meaningful little things were. And to see then in Exodus the simplicity of the unleavened bread and how significant it was for them. I have a paper here written by a Brazilian author called Matthias Grenzer, who wrote about unleavened bread, its symbolism. And he points out that there are many important and significant symbolic connotations in unleavened bread that carry meaning forward. The people are supposed to keep producing unleavened bread as they celebrate Passover in the future. But he talks about several things that they remember as they're preparing it. Number one, the simplicity. He writes that together with the Exodus narrative, it makes sense that the unleavened bread as a simple and less nutritious food represents living conditions marked by poverty and violent oppression. Meaning wherever you are, when you get to the land, even in the future, never forget that simplicity of who you were back in the day. He also mentions the reversal. The unleavened bread also indicates the reversal of a situation in which a repressive regime imposes misery on thousands of people, an entirety of people. And then he says that the bread must be eaten, and this is on our chapter here, 12:15, for 7 days. Mm. So like the 7 days of the creation of the world, the period in which unleavened bread is eaten to celebrate the memory of the Exodus dynamic is aimed at the new creation with a desire to return to the original freedom and dignity. And then he talks about this also future dynamic, that you eat unleavened bread, which is simple, it's the bread of the poor, with roasted meat over the fire, which is a symbol of wealth and richness. So it's almost like you carry this tension with you of a future, of the hope, and of who we were in the past. So I just love this paper by Grenzer talking about the meaningfulness of these symbolisms in the 12th chapter of the book of Exodus. Symbolic actions. You're right, Matilda, that give meaning to our religious lives.
The one element of the Passover is the place where it talks about the blood being touched unto the door. It's touched unto the door. That is why the Passover story connects with the story with Moses and his son and Zipporah.
We did mention we were going to bring it up. So we're unpinning that. Go ahead, Matilda.
Because the mother, Zipporah, is cutting the foreskin and then touching it onto him. And in this part with the Passover, the blood is touched onto the doorposts. And then the next part that the text, how the text reads, is when you do that, then I will see the blood and I will limp over it.
Interesting.
I will pass over, says the literal translation in English, but the expression is God is needs to like, he's like a limping God. And he's like kind of like jumping over that place. I don't know if this is the right imagery, but think back on all those places where somebody, like, for example, Abel gets killed by Cain, his brother, and God sees and speaks of the blood that is crying out to me. And here, all these people in Egypt have died. So many, thousands and thousands, and especially the firstborns have died. And now we meet a limping God.
Oh, wow.
A God who is hurt, like a human hurt on the body. And that is maybe the God that we will have to carry forward into the rest of the story in the book.
Wow. It's almost as if the text of Exodus is, again, anticipating things that we will, that we not only have seen, as you've mentioned, Matilda, coming from Genesis forward, but also in the end with the incarnation of Christ, of embodying that kind of a pain. Isaiah talking about the afflictions that the people will experience will be embodied by the one who is to come and then cross. It's almost as if Jesus ends up being like that utmost revelation of the hurting God, right? Moltmann talking about the crucified God and that kind of a suffering. That's beautiful. I mean, from symbolic actions to echoes to Genesis and anticipating the future of Jesus, maybe one last note before we close that I want our listeners to hold on to maybe, is this simple idea that they're celebrating deliverance while in bondage. The Passover is not instituted after freedom. It's instituted before, almost as if God is teaching people how to trust in Him to the point that we are celebrating something even before it happens because we rely on this God who will be who He will be. So there's a beautiful lesson in the Passover about the life of faith, about living and trusting God and celebrating deliverance and the hope of the resurrection even before it happens, simply because we trust this God who hurts and walks with us. My thanks go to my conversation partners, Matilda and Jody, our program engineer, Corin Bailey, and to all of you for listening. And for The Good Word, I'm Thiago Ahais.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.